In the history and the scholarship of the kibbutz, two words always go hand in hand, like strands of DNA: utopia and crisis. Utopia in crisis, awakening from utopia, the kibbutz in crisis, crisis and transformation. These are all titles of recent books or papers. Yuri Leviatin, the leading kibbutz scholar and former fellow here at the center, gave a talk at Ubiquo Privatization. It was entitled, "Is This the End of Utopia?" John Hershey, the American journalist, visited several kibbutzim for the New Yorker and declared, "The kibbutz of today is suffering a mortal crisis." That was back in 1952. In the 1920s, a group of settlers recorded a communal diary as they camped on a hilltop and prepared to break ground that was later published as Our Community. It's a fascinating document, and in it, their voices swing between hope for a better life and a fear of failure, of not living up to their own ideals. They hadn't even started their kibbutz, and already they wondered if their utopia was in crisis. I think the bipolar personality of the kibbutz stems in part from the fact that it remains, as one sociologist told me, a risk society. What he meant was that in a kibbutz, no external power is forcing you to stay and live that way. Every day is a risk. Every day you wake up and you have to ask yourself, do I remain a kibbutzman? Should I leave and try to make my life my way in the outside world? Should I vote to change the structure of my own home? The sense of crisis also seems the flip side of all utopian thought. And just look at the backlash at the Obama administration, the rising anxiety that his promise of change won't be fulfilled. Compare that to the very un-utopian vision of a Stephen Harper, in which an administration might step on the gas or the brakes here and there, call it stimulus funding, but it's the invisible hand of the market on the steering wheel, so who can really be blamed if things slide a little off course? Business as usual, business as usual. We hold our utopians up to higher standards. Crisis, of course, breeds opportunity. Despite the turmoil caused by recent changes, many kibbutzim have learned to adapt. After nearly 20 years of decline, population growth has steadied and started to rise again in the last few years. A study released just last week found that 70% of members are satisfied with life on their kibbutz, either traditional or privatized, while only 5% were dissatisfied, and 78% were happy in their jobs. In 2002, when the privatization debate was first heating up, only 58% said they were happy. Dr. Ben Raphael, who chaired the committee on the definition of the kibbutz, told me that rather than a zombie category, these multiple ways of imagining the kibbutz had given the movement a new vitality. They had freed members to adapt and evolve their communities again. In fact, many kibbutzim are building add-on neighborhoods that have proven attractive to outsiders because of the kibbutz's high reputation for education, daycare, a natural setting, and its high standard of life. As another expert told me, the kibbutz is a name, a kind of social good. It's a brand. The evolution of the kibbutz brand has also helped to promote a third type of kibbutz, the urban kibbutz. These are non-agricultural groups of mostly idealistic young people living communally, often in impoverished Arab or immigrant neighborhoods, and working as teachers or in other social services. They have taken up the torch of peace and justice from the original pioneers. But that torch continues to burn in surprising ways. Kibbutz Samar was founded in the 70s by disillusioned kibbutzniks and kibbutz children and remains based on anarchistic principles. Members on this hippie kibbutz set their own work schedules and take what money they need from a common purse. Everyone is equal and bureaucracy is reduced. It's also part of a small green kibbutz movement devoted to organic farming, alternative energy, and ecological socialism that is aligned with the global eco-village movement. Even those on the opposite side of the political spectrum have claimed the good name of the kibbutz. Right-wing religious settlers recently built an illegal outpost in the occupied territories and called it Kibbutz Gavat Menachem. They figured, wrongly as it turned out, that the government wouldn't knock down a settlement with the kibbutz label on it. Outside of Israel, the idea of kibbutz continues to inspire. And just in Seattle, the Ravina kibbutz provides koa housing for young Jews. There are similar developments in Brooklyn, Portland, and Toronto. In South Africa, Kibbutz Lubner has formed a collective community for intellectually challenged adults that gives them meaningful labor. In Haiti, even before the devastating earthquakes, the kibbutz was promoted by several observers as a model of success around which to organize the small cooperative economies that already exist in that troubled nation. 100 years later, the kibbutz still stands as a symbol of the possibilities of working together rather than against each other for a kind of social good. That even in the midst of crisis, we can still aspire to utopia. What are the lessons of the kibbutz? I think there are many lessons that the kibbutz experience can offer us here in Canada. But perhaps in the spirit of this talk, I'd better debate it as a group rather than preach to you from a podium. So let me just repeat a few. The question of sustainable size. How do you find the balance between a community or cooperative institution small enough to maintain genuine interpersonal connections, friends in more than just that Facebook sense, and yet all embracing it and porous enough to avoid becoming a self-selecting elite, cut off from the rest of society? These are challenges of growth faced by co-ops and the university. The importance, I think, of gossip, story, and myth to creating a binding sense of community. Gossip as a basic glue between people with shared interests. Story as a fundamental way we make meaning out of the randomness of our world. And myth as a master narrative that sustains a vision of how to live as a fully human community, in love and in labor, against the eroding pressures of bottom-line thinking and the cult of bureaucratic efficiency. If the co-op movement and the university are to fulfill their own utopian ideals, I think they need to breathe life back into their own myths. They need poets and artists to complement the visions of accountants and administrators. Finally, the influence of public space. We need to remember that even as our own virtual lives rewire our brains in unpredictable ways, our built environment, what internet speak knows as meat space, still impresses its philosophy upon our minds and our bodies. The kibbutz was always conscious of how architecture might affect its citizens, the importance of creating spaces and excuses for the daily rituals of breaking bread together, the danger that a tea kettle or a television in every room might pose to a sense of community. In the 21st century, we are building online economies that rival those of real nations. We are constructing LEED standard offices and classrooms that tread lightly on the earth they've dug up. But are we thinking about whether these public spaces, real and virtual, encourage or discourage the acts of communion that make us all alive to our potential? Let me just end with a quote from Joshua Sobel, and he was one of Israel's leading playwrights, who also lived for a time on Kibbutz Shamir, although long before I was there. He left the kibbutz to make a career in the city, and many of his plays deconstruct the secret myths of Israel and its pioneers, that he can still look back to Galilee and see the importance of the communal ideal. Of all that happened in our time, he writes, only one thing will remain in our collective kibbutz, not the yeshivas, nor the towns, nor the build-your-own-house neighborhoods, not in the shopping centers. All these, along with the materialism, privatization, property sales, exist all over the world and are of no interest to anyone. The kibbutz is the most original creation, not only in Israel, but in the whole 20th century, will become more and more significant as the time passes. The kibbutz may be in crisis, but then it always has been. The second generation of kibbutzniks were famously described as the children of the dream. Anyone touched by the magic of kibbutz life, I think, is a child of that same dream, one that continues to evolve and light a path toward, if not utopia, than a different, more just and humane way of life. Thank you.